very rich cracker heritage.
Thank you. As she said, my name is Ada Forney, and I am an oral tradition storyteller. The stories I tell are original stories. They were passed down through four generations in my family. And I'll just kind of hold these up. It's a little far for you to see at this size, but this is as far back as I can go in photographs. In this large family group here, two of those gentlemen turned out to be my great-grandfathers. They were brothers. That's what's wrong with all of us. Or as my husband likes to say, what's right with us. And these are my great-grandfathers, my grandparents, my mother, my father, and the little girl in the cow person outfit is me when I was 5 years old. And just to prove that that picture is genuine, I still have my very first pair of boots. And that's only one of about three pair I have of the little boots. It all started with my great-grandfather, James Jackson Lewis. Now, we all have a James Jackson Lewis in our family. They're the ones that are the colorful ones that, well, he had four wives and 19 children that we know about. And he lived in the town of, well, near Nashville in Berrien County in South Georgia. He was the oldest of the Lewis family. And, well, he was a handsome man and the only one in that part of Georgia with a surrey. Leastways, it looked like a surrey. It's actually a buggy trimmed out. If you didn't do too careful of an inspection, it'd pass. Now, there was nothing that made the reputation of a Southern belle more solidly in the community in those days than having been seen riding in a surrey, especially with someone as handsome as James Jackson Lewis. Problem was, after four or five or maybe half a dozen rides in that surrey, down the long, winding red clay roads, with occasional detour into the woods. You guys are grown ups, so I can tell you that part. The young woman would suddenly be overcome by a strong desire to travel. Now, it was usually said that she was tending to some sickly relative or making the grand tour of Europe if her family had the money. Problem was, she'd return in about, oh, 3 or 4 years' time with a toddler in tow and a story of true tragedy and lost love. Seems while she was tending to that relative or making the grand tour of Europe, she'd met, married, and become pregnant by the man of her dreams, only to have him snatched from her life. A victim of the dreaded influenza or a duel fought over some imagined insult. Problem was, as that toddler began to get a little older, he took on a striking resemblance to one James Jackson Lewis. I did mention that he was married to the first of his eventually four wives, with several of his 19 children already on the scene. Well, the fathers and the circuit-riding preachers of Berrien County decided they needed to get together and find a way to solve this one-man population explosion. So they called a town meeting, everybody sat down, and, well, two or three suggestions were put forward. And finally, the preacher stood up and said, "Let's put up a tent. Let's have ourselves a revival. We're going to bring that man to Jesus." But they'd had one too many tent revivals in that part of Georgia. There was a feller from down here in Florida stood up and he said, "Y'all know about that kind of crazy feller, Henry Flagler's building that railroad all the way to Key West? He hired some folks we call homeless today. They were called hobos back then, victims of corporate downsizing in those days. Flagler gave him $12 and sent him south to Florida." Now, they worked in some terrible conditions. They worked in the swamps and the bogs. It was terrible, and the work was hard. But he said, "I heard a story about something y'all might be able to use to stop this population problem you've got." He said, "There is a critter down there attacked one of these fellers called Skeetericus gigundus, the gallon nipper skeeter, able to drain a human body of all its blood in a single bite. Why, this creature was so terrifying that even by the time I came along, I heard rumors of the infamous gallon nipper skeeters. Every child lived in fear of being accosted by one." Well, seems that feller crawled under a washtub. Those skeeters drilled through that washtub with their beaks. He banged their beaks down and they flew off. And the next day were the very first reports of unidentified flying objects. I mean, skeeters. Seen in the skies above Gulf Breeze, Florida. Well, the fathers of Berrien County weren't sure they wouldn't turn something that vicious loose on the population. They did enjoy their evening walks, after all. So they decided to table the discussion and meet again in a month's time. Well, sure enough, about 2 weeks later, my great-grandfather, James Jackson Lewis, suddenly pulled up stakes and moved south to Florida. Now, there was the official version of that story that said he was going to start the second Lewis Family Truck Farm. But there was another version. It rattled around in the family closet with the rest of the skeletons. You see, it seems that James Jackson Lewis, well, seems that it was a father, or God forbid a husband with a shotgun that sent my great-grandfather south to Florida. Now, he arrived in the city of Mayo, and when he walked down the streets of the city, he saw that the front yards, side yards, backyards, even the sidewalks were covered in every available growing vegetable crop. There was money to be made growing vegetables in Florida, and they grew everything from asparagus to zucchini here in the rich land. And that Flagler fella, whenever he'd run low on money, he would build a hotel. He was the inventor of the tourist trap here in Florida. Y'all know that. He'd build a hotel and hire magazine writers and newspaper men to come to Florida and to write about the hunting and fishing and farming here. Now, this is a real important question. I have to tell you, the skeptics are getting younger every day. How many of y'all believe everything you read? Even the third graders don't raise their hand anymore. Mr. Flagler's men wrote that if you towed a hole in the ground with your shoe and dropped a seed before you could turn around twice and spring up and put on a crop, that's how rich the land was here in Florida. So after walking down the streets and watching all those vegetables coming up out of the ground, he went to the banks in Berrien County. He established himself with letters from the banks in Berrien County, and he bought himself a good-sized chunk of raw Florida scrub. Now, he hired a supervisor and some sharecroppers to bring in the crops, and then he turned to my grandfather, Homer. Now, Homer didn't have many regionalisms in his speech, but he was what he used to like to call a kid of a boy. He was 9 years old at the time. Now, I know 9-year-olds whose parents won't let them cross the street by themselves. But using one of these, and this is one of my prized possessions, this was auctioned off by the Folklore Society back in 2000 at the festival, and I bought enough tickets to make sure it went home with me. This is a genuine Curly Deagle. It's, well, one of the last, I guess, Mr. Deagle made. He died just a couple of years after that, I believe. It is a signed edition, and it is a Florida Cracker cow whip. Or in some cases, it's called a cow drag. Now, the most popular definition of cracker, and y'all do know what that is, and I don't mean Nabisco, is from the cracking of these whips. They would lash it around their head in a circle. The tip of this whip exceeds the speed of sound over 749 miles an hour. It is like a gun going off, if you've ever heard one have, going off quite near to you. And the popping of this, see, there you go. Thank you, Butch. Thank you. And is everything. And the cracking of those whips is the most common definition of the term cracker, but it's not the only one. See, we eat cracked corn or grits. Y'all have heard that song. Jimmy cracked corn and I don't care. And some say, well, it's because we eat those little crackers down here. And well, when the Spanish came back to Florida after the second Spanish period, there are many white people here already. They were Quakers called Cuajeros by the Spanish. Some say that was corrupted into the term cracker. There is another one. We don't like to talk about it much. You see, I got this from a seventh generation Floridian named Bill Souter, who told me that there's a feller over in England named Shakespeare. He wrote a play, and in that play was a character called Cracker, who was a liar, braggart, and a fool. So I want you all to look at me and shake your head. Yes, you are going to believe everything I tell you. You guys have me worried there for a minute. So using one of these, and there was nothing left of my grandfather's when he passed away. My grandfather, at the tender young age of 9, drove 100 head of cracker cattle across the state line into Florida. Now, when they arrived at the Lewis Ranch, they notched the ears with the Lewis brand and turned them loose on the open range. Wasn't time for the vegetable crops to be harvested, and it wasn't time for the cattle drive. And, well, if there was one thing my great-grandfather loved more than beautiful women, it was money. And he purely did not like having to pay that bank loan at the end of the month. So he took on a second job working as a game warden in the Okefenokee Swamp. Now, y'all know about the Okefenokee. It is a weird and mysterious place filled with strange, eerie fogs and quicksand bogs that could pull a man down before he could cry out for help. And it was rumored that the earliest peoples, the Timucua, the Ais, the Giagas, the Calusas, buried their dead in the peat bogs, and that the ghosts of the warriors rose to haunt the swamps at night. Oh, but my great-grandfather wasn't afraid. He'd hunted, fished, and trapped in that swamp all of his life. He took my grandfather Homer along because he was the best shot in all of southern Georgia and Florida. Grew up to be a championship rifleman on the Army rifle team with warehouses of trophies to his credit. Now, they were walking through the swamp one day on their duly appointed rounds. Now, this is a real important question, and you adults are never as honest as third-grade children. When I ask this question, the boys look at the girls look at the boys, every hand goes up. How many of y'all know somebody ugly? Tell you what I mean? Now, they were walking through the swamp one day when they came across the ugliest man either one of them had ever seen. Now, it wasn't odd to see somebody ugly back then any more than it is today. Man had a long stringer of fish with him that trailed on the ground, but Flagler's men had written that there were so many fish in the rivers and streams of Florida, you could walk across them on the backs of those fish without ever getting your shoes wet. Y'all do believe everything you read. The odd thing was there's no way that man could have caught them fish. There was no cane pole, no red wiggler worms, no fly rod, no net, no sign of the dynamite some folks used to catch fish in the swamp. So being a duly appointed officer of the law, my great-grandfather strode up to that man and said, "Excuse me, sir, I need to know how you dispatch them fish." He turned that great ugly face up to my great-grandfather and he said, "I uglied them to death." Now, sir, I grew up in a fine oral tradition in the South. I know about tall tales, and I purely do not believe this one. I'm going to need some proof. So the man laid down that stringer fish. He walked over to a clear pool, picked up the only other thing he had with him, which was a lantern, and he hung it out over that pool of water. And, well, pretty soon all those fish came to the surface. And when they did, that man took a stance. He scowled the ugliest face you've ever seen down into that water. And the most amazing thing happened. The surface of that pond became covered in stunned and dying fish. My great-grandfather turned to that man. He said, "My God, sir, you are ugly." Man said, "You think I'm ugly, ought to see my wife." Well, we figured she's no beauty queen being married to you and all, sir, but tell me, she's ugly, why don't you bring her fishing with you? He said, "Oh, I can't do that. When she scows down in that water, the meat and the guts of them fish get mixed up. You can't eat them when she's done." Well, my grandfather Homer and my great-grandfather James Jackson Lewis made their way back to the farm in Mayo, making sure to stay as far as possible away from any opportunity of meeting that man again, or most especially his wife. Well, as was James Jackson's wont, he eventually got divorced yet one more time, sold the land, and moved on. Now, he slowly came down the coast until he settled in the city of Sebastian, Florida. And after listening to Mr. Pacetti this morning, this is the only story I could finish with. You see, it seems that was getting on to Thanksgiving. Now, if you know much about the Indian River Lagoon back in those days, they didn't eat turkey for Thanksgiving. They didn't eat ham. Instead, they used cast nets. And they would go out and they would throw those nets in a perfect circle. Those nets had float down, those weights had kissed the water, those fish were caught before they knew what was happening to them. Well, it was getting on to Thanksgiving, and so my great-grandfather, James Jackson Lewis, called to my grandfather, Homer. He said, "Now, come on here, boy." He said, "Let's go out here and catch ourselves our Thanksgiving feast." So they went down to the end of the dock at Judas Fish House, and if you drive through the city of Sebastian today, down on the riverside, you'll see Judas Fish House is still there, run by Mr. Judah's descendants. And if you continue on down the road to Riverside Park, there's an old, tall, two-story house. It's a historic site now. That was my great-grandfather's original house in the city of Sebastian, Florida. So left the house, went down to Judah's, got into their boat, and they took that boat down to their favorite fishing spot. Now, it was one of those rare early cold spells like we're having right now, right before Thanksgiving. And J.J. took my grandfather Homer with him because Homer could throw a net. That was wonderful to watch Mr. Pacetti do that this morning. I haven't seen it done by a master caster in a long time. But my grandfather Homer could throw that net in a perfect circle. It'd float down those weights, kiss the water, and those fish were caught before they knew what was happening to them. But on about the third cast, the breeze came up, and the breeze was just enough to cause my grandfather Homer to lose his balance and fall into the river. Now, Homer was never a very big man. He was small and slender. And so J.J. reached down, lifted him up, put him back in the boat, and that breeze started to blow. And the boy started shivering, turning blue. So J.J. rowed over to the shore. He reached down, took the boy out of the boat. They went over and found a little clearing. They started a fire. My great-grandfather took off my grandfather's clothes, spread them out over some palmetto fronds to dry. They staked out some fish. They sat down, and they proceeded to have themselves a little pre-Thanksgiving feast. Now, as they finished the fish, my great-grandfather got up to go back out to the river to finish the fishing. And as he did, it happened. The air was split by the cry of a wild Florida panther. And Homer began shivering from something besides the cold. Being a master hunter, J.J. tested the wind. Oh, that cat's a couple hours away. Boy, ain't gonna bother you none. Just remember the rule. Keep the fire burning. Now, let's see if y'all can play around like the children do when I do this story. What's that first rule? Keep the fire burning. Now, Homer's laying there. He'd had fish. He was full. It was warm. And all he had to do was make sure the fire stayed burning. Well, he started poking away at that fire, and he started slowly drifting off to sleep. Snap! He came straight awake. He looked across that clearing. He found himself staring into the eyes of the biggest Florida black bear he had ever seen. Now, thanks to the husband of this lovely young lady sitting here in the audience, I have a cast of a Florida black bear paw. That'll give you an idea of the size of the bear. We were out at the Ocala National Forest when Eric took us over and showed us where he got his bear paw cast, and we made one. Now, bears are slow, but they're smart in the ways of the woods. You can almost see the wheels in that bear's mind turning as it looked from the fish to the boy, from the boy to the fish. You know, that boy was a considerably larger mouthful. That's when Homer made his second mistake. The first one, remember that rule? What was it? That boy had let that fire go plumb out. It was nothing but cold ash. You see, you never run from a bear. You lay down, play dead, or you step behind a tree or bush so he can't see you. But Homer panicked. He forgot. He jumped up and he took off running. And when he did, down on all fours went that bear and right behind him. That's when Homer made his next mistake. He shinnied up the first tree, came to his old brittle oak. He shinnied out onto the end of a limb. So he forgot black bears can climb. Right up behind him went that bear. Now, as I said, bears are smart in the ways of the woods. And the bear took that paw and started pushing down on that limb. And each time he pushed, that limb snapped. Until finally that limb snapped off, and down Homer fell. That's when he got lucky, sorta. See, he landed in the one place that bear was most unlikely to go. He landed bottom side down in the largest patch of prickly pear cactus in all of Central Florida, clipping one of those prickly pear pads and jamming it in when he landed. He cleared a little place away and he stood up. The bear shinnied down the tree and stood at the edge of the prickly pear looking at the boy and the cactus and the cactus and the boy. And, you know, that cactus, that bear stuck that paw out and began pressing down on one of those spines. And about the time it broke through the skin, the breeze came up. And on that breeze was the smell of freshly roasting fish. And that was all it took. Down that bear went and back towards that clearing. Homer was standing there. He was in considerable pain. And he grew up just like I did with an old Southern grandmother. I grew up in the city of Vero Beach, Florida, sleeping under a quilt in the middle of summer with no air conditioning, only a box fan and a little air hole to make sure I didn't suffocate to death because I knew they were out there. My grandmother had told me about the little jumping spiders that bite your teeth died or the ghosts and other strange creatures that wandered the night. He heard that when they tore out the prickly pears, they found the bones of small animals and children who'd been stranded there till they'd starved to death. He's never going to see his daddy or his brothers and sisters again. Then he heard the river lapping up against the shore, and he remembered on Sunday, they'd been sitting in the parlor of the old house there in Sebastian. One of his sisters had been a-playing the pump organ. And they'd been a-singing, "Shall we gather at the river, the beautiful river?" He heard a voice quietly calling his name, "Homer, Homer." It was his mama coming to take him home to heaven. When the voice got a little louder, "What's the matter with you, boy? Look up over your head." It was his daddy with a rope over the branch of a considerably stronger tree. Well, Homer grabbed that rope and JJ pulled him to safety. He ran over and he grabbed my great-grandfather and hugged him, and JJ reached down, tossed his hair. He said, "What did I tell you, boy? What was that first rule? Y'all remember? Keep that fire burning." He said, "I had to start that fire back up, put some fish out to get that bear away from you. But you know, I think that bear's in for a little surprise, because as I left that clearing, the panther we heard earlier showed up." As they walked to the boat, the screams of the panther and the growls of the bear filled the air around them. Homer rode home in the boat standing up. In fact, Homer ate Thanksgiving dinner standing up. In fact, the day he died, just about 10, 15 years ago now, he said he occasionally found a prickly pear spine in a place where it hadn't ought to be. Well, eventually my grandfather grew up. He went into the United States Army. They sent him home, put him up in the Biltmore Hotel after Anzio. Two bullets in him, and the malaria is so bad they said he wouldn't live 6 months. They thought 6 months would be it. When the 6 months was up, my grandfather retired from the United States Army, moved to Vero Beach, Florida, began building houses, and well, when I came along, when I was 5 years old, they adopted and raised me for the rest of my life. My grandparents were amazing people. My grandfather died at the ripe old age of 97. So much for 6 months to live. Now, this last story is a memory story from my own childhood. I walked into the living room and pulled open the curtains, and I stared up at that mango tree full of fruit. As I traced down the trunk, I remember bringing it home from his garden to mine when it was no bigger around than my little finger. There at the base of the tree were those black plastic flower pots, slender green leaves, and a big stalk poking up out of one. When the stalk opened, there were three buds inside, and they turned into the most beautiful white amaryllis you have ever seen, 8 inches from tip to tip. And as I stared at them, suddenly I was 8 years old again on that lot next to our house with the smooth handle of that rake in my hand, and I fell into that motion of raking the pine needles and the oak leaves. I caught a glimpse of a movement, and when I looked up, I swear he's standing right there. You could see him if you look real hard. He's not a very big man, not any taller than I am now. Bragged the day he died he could buy shoes in the boys' department at Patrick Air Force Base. He was wearing the khaki-colored work clothes he bought at the base, a big straw hat. You could see that red-brown complexion from that Cherokee Indian great-grandmother all us Southerners are supposed to have. Silvery white tufts of hair, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, "Want to go for a ride, Mutt?" Oh, yes, sir. He called me Mutt for Mutt and Jeff, the cartoon strip. He brought the wheelbarrow over. We filled it high, and he picked me up and threw me in the middle, and we began a crazy dance over to the fruit trees. We had everything in our yard. Pineapples, mangoes, oranges, grapefruit, ponderosa lemons, 23 pies from a single piece of fruit. We could graft and bud, so we had oranges on one side, tangerines on the other. It was an amazing place as a child. As I was placing the leaves around the base of the orange, I caught a whiff of a scent, and when I looked up into the branches, I saw the very first orange blossoms. And I knew when the very first piece of fruit was ripe, my grandfather would pick it, roll it between his hands, take out that pearl-handled pocket knife, carve a perfect circle, cut out a plug, run the knife blade around the inside, and hand it to me. I can still taste the tangy sweetness of that juice, and to this day, Valencia is my favorite orange. When the flow of the juice slowed, I'd stick my thumbs in, rip the orange apart, pull those plugs out until my entire face was covered in sweet, sticky orange juice. He looked over at me and he said, "Come on, Mutt, let's go inside. Annie ought to have lunch ready by now. Can't no one put on a spread like my grandmother Annie." Oh, there'd be fried chicken, rolled in flour, fried in bacon grease. You can't add cholesterol to food. My grandmother was an expert. There'd be gravy made from the drippings. There'd be mashed potatoes, avocado salad, and at the end of the table, fresh coconut cake made from coconuts picked on the beach in Vero, back when they used to grow crazy down there. As we walked around the edge of the house, he said, "Look, Mutt, the amaryllis are in bloom again." And there were those same black plastic flower pots, those beautiful white flowers. And suddenly, as I stood there staring out at them, a song comes to me from the past, and I ask you if you'd like to please join me. Precious memories, how they linger, how they ever flood my soul. In the stillness of the midnight, precious sacred scenes unfold. I know that every year of my life, when I walk into that living room and I open that curtain and I look up that mango tree full of fruit and I trace down that trunk to those black plastic flower pots, the slender green leaves, and those beautiful white lilies, I'll remember my grandparents. I remember how on Sundays my grandmother would go out and pick some of those amaryllis, some baby's breasts, some leather ferns, some Easter lilies, and place them on either side of the altar of the third church that my grandfather helped to build in the city of Vero Beach. And that yet another precious memory will come flooding back, another of the stories passed down over four generations in my family. Stories like Homer and the Bear, stories like Gunter and the Hog, all amazing tales, original stories, passed down from people with almost no education, but a real gift with words. And so it is my great privilege today to share with you the stories that I was told as a child, the stories I grew up hearing in my grandparents' house in the city of Vero Beach, Florida. My name is Ada Forney, and I'm a storyteller. And I want to thank you all for listening to the stories that were passed down over all those generations. Thank you.